From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with media critic Todd Gitlin. He's a former SDS president who's just written a book about the political and cultural radicalism of the 1960s. Also today, I talk with syndicated political cartoonist Dan Wasserman. His cartoons about aid to the Contras, the president, and the Pope are collected in a new book. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Art Farmer's new album of music composed by Billy Strayhorn. And television critic David Bianculli previews Beverly Hills Bunce, the Hill Street Blues spinoff starring Dennis Franz. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Todd Gitlin. His new book, The 60s, Years of Hope, Days of Rage, is about the new left and the counterculture of the 1960s. This interpretive history is partly autobiographical. Gitlin was elected president of SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society, in 1963. He went on to lead anti-war demonstrations, organize Appalachian white migrants in Chicago, and write for underground newspapers. He ran through clouds of tear gas to escape police billy clubs during the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago and at People's Park in Berkeley in 1969. He writes, "From mildly socialist, I became radical and ambivalently found myself caught up in the collective hallucination of the revolution." Gitlin is now a media critic and a professor of sociology at the University of California at Berkeley. His first book, The Whole World is Watching, analyzed mass media coverage of the anti-war movement. One of the goals Todd Gitlin had for his new book was to reclaim the actual 60s from the current clichés about the 60s. He told me some of the cliché versions of the 60s that he wanted to dispel.
One is that everything that happened was wonderful. Another is that everything that happened was catastrophic and ruined America. A third is that everyone was larger than life and strode through in an incendiary way, burning everything down. I call it the Big Bang theory of history, the notion that everything happened at once. You know, hey, it's John Lennon and Bobby Kennedy and Hubert Humphrey and Lyndon Johnson and the war in Vietnam and Martin Luther King, brought to you by Ed Sullivan or something like that. The 60s took 10 years to happen, and things were complicated and built up, and there were many trajectories. They did have in common that we were trying to change history in various ways, and did some and didn't some. But I think it took a long time to stretch out.
Is there a memory that crystallizes for you some of the commitment and excitement that you felt in the 1960s?
Many. I tried to organize the book around such moments. I'll just give you one that comes to mind.
Yeah,
I don't know that it's more representative. I wrote about the Chicago street demonstrations in 68 at the Democratic Convention, and I, on the great day when clouds of tear gas were spewing through the streets, Bloody Wednesday, I think it was known as later, I found myself running through clouds of tear gas and stopping to mop my eyes and looking up at the water fountain and seeing that the person standing next to me was Jules Pfeiffer. And we decided to run together, and we ran down Michigan Avenue a while longer, and then he took me by the arm and said, "Let's go in here," and ushered me into the Haymarket Bar in the Hilton Hotel, which was the center of the demonstrations because all the delegates were staying there. And we sat down in this bar. I think I probably hadn't changed my shirt in a couple of days, and it was very hot. And here were the waitresses in low-cut dresses and bringing us daiquiris. We sat down with William Styron and Studs Terkel. And outside, people are streaming by in clouds of tear gas. And I'm sitting there drinking daiquiris. And the television is on. And Paul Newman, who was a McCarthy delegate from Connecticut, was talking about the war. And it was the height of surrealism and sleeplessness and a little drunkenness. People are still streaming by outside. And inside is this gay 90s decor. And we're all talking about how awful everything is. And I knew that Pfeiffer was a McCarthy delegate from New York. And I turned to him. He was my hero. I had read him in high school in the 50s. And I said, more or less, do something. And he said that he was scared. And I thought to myself, my God, Jules Pfeiffer is scared. You know, then things are really serious. Meantime, the gas is still streaming by, and I'm feeling very much out of place. And there comes a moment when I decide I simply have to be out there. And I get up after my two daiquiris and stumble out through the lobby, which is full of stink bomb fumes, deposited, as it turned out, by some of my friends, and ran back out into the tear gas. I mean, I suppose that story symbolizes both, you could call it the commitment and the insanity, and the sense that I had that however crazy was what was going on in the streets, it was where I had to be, at least to have played a part in that.
I want to get back to Chicago in a few minutes. Let me ask you first, you became the president of SDS when you were 22 years old. 20
and a half.
Even younger. Looking back, do you ever think to yourself about how young you really were when you were the head of SDS?
Sure. I've thought often, yes, I have. What did I know?
Did you feel young at the time? Did you assume that you had a better kind of grasp of the world than looking back you think you really did?
Sure. Although I think actually I wasn't quite so dumb then. Maybe I got dumber later from time to time. But I had already maybe 2.5 years of political, 3 years of political experience at that time, and it was Harvard in the early 60s, and there were people around, our professors, who were plugged into the Kennedy administration, and I had been around Washington for a couple of summers, and I had met lots of officials, and I read a lot, and so I think I knew a thing or two. I also was aware that I was out of place here. I'd only been in the organization for a few months. I'd only been to one meeting before, and it was kind of a fluke that I submitted to this election. It felt like submission because I didn't want to be a leader. But, of course, we didn't believe in leadership. Nobody wanted to do it. And so I stepped forward onto the gangplank.
Now, you were pretty full-time devoted to politics. And being the head of SDS meant a full-time commitment without pay, right? You didn't get paid for being the president, did you?
Are you kidding?
Yeah, right. So what I'm wondering is, did you or did a lot of your friends end up going to graduate school or staying around the universities so that you could stay committed to the political cause, which was so centered around student politics and university organizing?
Well, we're jumping ahead a lot there. I never anticipated a university career, or any career at all, for that matter, except the movement. I mean, I was one of those people who thought that everything had been changed, and it made no sense to think in orthodox career terms. I thought of myself as a writer, I guess, more than anything else. Then, eventually, after that played out, by the early 70s, you looked around and you wanted to go on writing and talking and thinking about politics and culture and all these other things. And the landscape seemed to have eroded. The people that I knew who had been smart about politics were either dropping out of politics or burning out or had become less smart in some ways. And the university then seemed like all there was of an oasis. I mean, I knew other people who went elsewhere into other professions, and the media, of course, is one place where a lot of people went. For me, it made sense to go to the university in the spirit of the wonderful remark of Hunter S. Thompson, when the going gets tough, the weird turn pro.
But I'm thinking, too, you know, with the student politics movement, it was it was so easy to graduate from it only because after a certain number of years, you're not a student anymore. And I think a lot of people became graduate students more to stay politically active than to attend graduate classes.
That's true in a sense, although it's also true that in my generation in SDS, we had concluded by 65. Well, two things, actually. One was that we should all leave the campus and go out into the so-called real world.
Into the community.
Yeah, that was the first thing we did, was to try to organize an interracial movement of the poor. But also, we had in the back of our minds that SDS was only a student organization and there ought to be a sequel. We did know that people stopped being students. And so starting in 64, we started paying lip service to the idea that there should be a post-student, general, radical, ecumenical organization. And in fact, in the book, I tell the story of what happened when we tried to organize a conference to do that. We organized in 67 something called the Back to the Drawing Boards Conference in a campground in Michigan. And we had 150 or 200 people who were already getting old enough to thinking about being lawyers and doctors and teachers and so on. And the thing was disrupted by the Diggers, who were these countercultural wild men, very interesting sort of very smart anarchist druggers from San Francisco who drifted in. They'd heard about this thing, and they basically drifted in and took over, turning on Abbie Hoffman in the process, who was visiting, and it would arrive there with Paul Krasner of The Realist to look into this thing. And they paralyzed us. They mau-mau'd us. They basically baited us as a bunch of middle-class panty waists and so on.
Well,
We let them do it, amazingly enough.
Tell a story of some of the things that they said to you when the diggers crashed this meeting.
Well, they barged in and they said, you know, you're a bunch of middle class kids, and you know, first they need a lawyer because that one of them had driven the car into a canal, so they needed a straight person to help. So a straight person went off to help one of them, and then the rest of them, they kicked over tables, they denounced us as rich kids. They said that Where It's At is going actually into the community and giving people free food and so on. They read a poem by Gary Snyder cursing the white man and the Pentagon and so on. It was quite wild. There was a kind of pseudo fight. There was a terrorism. Somebody said that she was a mother, and they denounced all mothers and so on. It was right out of central casting. Quite ingenious of them to have tied us all up in knots.
Well, I think that story really illustrates one of the themes of your new book, The 60s, which is some of the conflicts between the cultural radicals and the political radicals.
Right. We often thought of trying to find a way to fuse or harness or marry the politicos and the hippies. And it was like the Holy Grail that everybody was looking for. And at various times, various people thought they had found it. I mean, Jerry Rubin and Abbie Hoffman thought they found it in their way. And there were a lot of people around Berkeley who thought, and I suppose I let myself think in giddier moments, that there was this creature stalking Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley who was super hip and super savvy and at the same time politically radical and serious. And this was some sort of new creature, like someone who'd walked out of the pages of William Blake. I confess I let myself think such things at times.
Do you think that there were conflicting goals between the political left and the cultural radicals?
Yeah. In fact, you could put it starkly. It would be a bit of an exaggeration, but you could put it starkly by saying that the politicos believed in creating something that was going to happen later. And the counterculture people wanted to bring God to be present now. Now, it's actually more complicated than that. I mean, part of the genius of the New Left and the civil rights movement was that they were in themselves countercultural. I mean, when you sat down at a lunch counter to integrate it, you were saying, the present is the future. I'm going to abolish segregation, not by making a demand or knocking on somebody's door or writing to my congressman, but by abolishing it right here and now. So there was actually a countercultural thread in the civil rights movement. The first people I ever heard use the language, do your thing, were people in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Southern Civil Rights Organizers. And they were already talking about soul sessions, which were later, I guess, sensitivity groups and so on, in 1965, if you can believe it. So it wasn't entirely crazy to think about bringing these two things together. Nonetheless, there was always this tension. Politicos wanted to have meetings and organize organizations and make something happen later on down the road.
And hippies wanted immediate gratification.
Yes, and they wanted to shake it out, you know, to express yourself. That was the other thing. Political radicals wanted to discipline themselves in order to make something else happen. And freaks wanted to undiscipline themselves and shake, rattle, and roll. So there was always that tension.
Now, I found it interesting. In your book, which has bits of autobiography interspersed, you say that you smoked your first joint about 2 years after you became the president of SDS.
Right.
So really, political radicalism came first in your life. I mean, chronologically first.
That's true. And a lot of the people in my crowd in SDS were very suspicious of that. And I think I also mentioned in
suspicious
there that,
of you
of
smoking?
Dope, yeah. And I remember at a party during the SDS convention in 67, when I was a little high, and a quite well-known leader of SDS came into a room where I was being that way. And I was having trouble, I think, finding the doorknob or something like that. And he looked at me and rolled his eyes as if, you know, a noble mind was here or a throne. Of course, later on, he was he was doing the same. I think, I know I also tell the story in there of how I was really fairly puritanical about this stuff. And when a be-in was organized in Chicago in 1967, in an echo of the San Francisco be-in on the shores of the lake, where one of the people who came down there with her legs painted in psychedelia was Bernadine Dorn, then a law student. I felt really quite troubled by the hippie organizers of this thing, because I thought it was sort of a delusion to think that you could simply go off and have a good time. I mean, maybe worse than a delusion, because after all, there was this hideous war on. And I actually toyed with the fantasy, believe it or not, of distributing a leaflet. There was a lot of talk in the media then about getting high by smoking banana peel. This is the mellow yellow period. And I had this crackpot idea that I should make up a leaflet that alerted potential banana peel smokers that, in fact, the people who pick bananas in Guatemala make 2 cents a day or something like that, and that would somehow turn them around. In retrospect, I think that I was simply trying to ward off the siren song of the counterculture myself, because a few months later I was living in California and growing my first beard.
So even the conflicts between the politicos and the hippies were happening inside of you.
Yes, and, right. And in many people, in fact.
That's right. Well, Todd, we'll talk some more in just a minute. We're going to take a short break now. My guest is Todd Gitlin. He's joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York. He's a writer, media critic, and a professor of sociology at the University of California at Berkeley. His new book is titled The 60s, Years of Hope, Days of Rage. We'll talk some more in just a moment after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Todd Gitlin is my guest, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, The 60s. Let's talk about confrontational politics, which was one of the really major issues for the New Left in the 1960s. And I'd like to go back to Chicago, which was the location of one of the first stories that you told during our interview. You described being in Chicago during the convention with tear gas in the streets. And it was a time when you really, when people were forced to decide what their tactics were, if they were comfortable with confrontation, if they were comfortable with violence, if they were willing to be tear gassed, if they were going to wait inside until that blew over. You write in your book that you had no illusions of being a street fighter, that you were somewhere in between not believing in it and not feeling tough enough. And I thought, well, that is probably such a typical feeling that so many people had, the kind of ambivalence that they felt about the confrontational tactics that were happening.
I think it was, and that what I said there was true. I think that I did hate violence, and I never perpetrated any. On the other hand, you felt constantly that if you weren't going to do that, what else were you going to do? I mean, you were always beating yourself inside your head with the need to do something else, and.
Because you felt that working within the system had failed.
Well, we felt we were getting nowhere. And in fact, we were actually, just looking at our impact on the war, we were actually having an impact on the war that we didn't understand. And part of the reason we didn't understand it is that the White House was lying about it. That is to say, they were saying always that we were having no impact. I mean, Nixon watched the football game instead of coming out to see the demonstration in 1969. In fact, we know now from documents that the White House was always looking over its shoulder, at the very least, at what was going on in the streets. Lyndon Johnson felt the pressure. We were always a veto force, but that was invisible. It was hard to get a reading of that. What you felt viscerally and what you experienced watching television and reading the papers was, they're sending more troops, they're dropping more bombs, it's more napalm, and what are we going to have to do to end the war? It felt, you know, again, you're in your 20s. The war now has become the central fact of your life. Whether you're a soldier or an anti-war soldier, that is the reality that you're living. And it swells, it's eating away at your brain. It feels like this plague, and you can't stop it. And it was out of that pressure that you started making allowances for people who were bringing, let's say, ball bearings to throw under the hooves of police horses at one demonstration in Oakland, or people who were bringing little spike balls to drop in front of traffic in Chicago during 68. I knew people who did both those things. Not that I wanted to do that, but I felt also, well, maybe there's something wrong with me that I'm not willing to do that. I think many people felt bullied in that way by the pressure to do something more.
Well, the confrontational tactics of the left brought about more police repression, more tear gas, more billy clubbing of protesters. But there was a shared feeling that this kind of repression was a good exercise in education about how repressive the government could really be. And you, for instance, say during Chicago that you were thinking, well, at least we've shown they can only rule at gunpoint. Do you want to explain that kind of thinking?
Well, it's so hard to recreate it, and I've had to plunge back into that mood in order to write about it. But in a way, it seems not to make any sense. I think we felt that we were involved in a project of unmasking, and that there was a real rationalism behind that. In other words, we thought, well, if everybody else sees what we see, then they'll understand that the rationales for the war and for all kinds of other injustice are threadbare. And everyone will therefore be like us, namely disabused of wrong ideas and freed to turn everything upside down. It's a terrible innocence in that, in an odd way. Now, of course, it doesn't necessarily follow that everybody sees the world we did. That's why it was a shock when, after Chicago, we learned that most people, according to the polls, who had watched the spectacle on television, thought that the cops had been right. See, we thought it would be obvious that anybody would side with us because we're the good guys. That sort of innocence was dangerous. There was also another idea that I wrote about here, which was in some ways more subtle and interesting. And this was the idea that if you polarize the country, if you forced all the sleeping dogs to awake, as Tom Hayden said to me in 1967, that there would be so much disruption and chaos in the society that the powers that be would be forced to end the war in order to cope with this chaos and tamp it down at home. That was, in some ways, a very seductive idea because it seemed to offer it a set of tactics that might work. It was also very dangerous because it meant that situations were created in which people became, in a sense, cannon fodder on the streets.
Well, you had friends who joined the Weather Underground and took this kind of thinking several steps further.
Mm-hmm.
And started making bombs to bomb buildings in protest of American imperialism.
Yep.
Were you able to ever talk with them about their change in direction?
You mean at the time?
At the time, yeah.
No, they had cut off connections. They were denouncing people like me as movement wimps and creeps and so on. And that was what they were doing to themselves. They were, in effect, turning themselves into a cult, breaking connections with family, with friends, with old comrades, basically drawing the line, saying you're either serious or you're unserious. If you were serious, you had to go underground, and you had to do that sort of thing. So starting in the fall of 69, I mean, there were people I knew who were even people who weren't going into the Weather Underground, who were saying other kind of wacky things. I mean, saying that Stalin was an important intellectual force to be reckoned with. And I remember reading an article by one such person who I'd known very well and writing her a letter and saying, how can you be saying these idiotic things? And, of course, she didn't and couldn't answer the letter because there was nothing she could have said.
I want to jump ahead to the present. Last week, there was a conference called the Second Thoughts Conference that was organized by David Horowitz and Peter Collier, two people who used to be radicals in the 60s. They were co-editors of Ramparts magazine. And in the past decade, they've become conservatives or neoconservatives. They voted for President Reagan. They've totally switched political sides.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a conference of people who, like Horowitz and Collier, were having second thoughts about their radical past and had become conservatives. Why did you go to the conference?
I went to write about it. I was not invited to it, and and I am writing about it for Tikkun magazine.
Now, you saw a lot of people stand up and explain what embarrassed them about their past or what motivated them to change and almost be politically born again.
Right.
What were some of the, we don't have a lot of time left, but
yes.
Briefly, what were some of the common themes that emerged?
There was one common theme among those people, which is that they had been so traumatized by what happened in Vietnam, the boat people, and what happened in Cambodia, the genocide, that they had disabused themselves of their old romanticism. Now, I have a lot of sympathy with that view. I don't think that a lot of the people who spoke at the conference actually agreed with Horowitz and Collier that you should go all the way and support Reagan. There's been a mistake. You know, the Wall Street Journal carried a piece saying there were 100 of these people at the conference. That's not so. There were 24 people of that generation who spoke at the conference. There were very few others in the audience. And believe me, I knew a lot of people in the 60s. And most of the audience was not made up of more of that crowd. And I would say maybe a third of the people on that platform were very much out of sympathy with Reaganism, and they were speaking from the heart about experience. They would have been better placed at another conference which would not have been in the Reagan orbit.
Now, here's what I want to ask you. There were some people at this conference who had second thoughts and had therefore totally shifted political direction and political affiliation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in your book, The 60s, you look back on the politics and culture of the 60s in its most radical expressions. And you're very critical of some of the things that have happened, but that doesn't mean, right, that you have shifted in political direction or that you want to renounce the things that you did then.
Exactly. And that was true of other people at the conference, too. I rose at one point in some indignation and made a little intervention in which I said that I identified with the Third Thought Caucus. I don't think I needed to hear David Horowitz to tell me to have second thoughts. In fact, everybody I've known has had second, third, fourth, and eighth thoughts for 20 years now. Part of what was exciting and powerful in the 60s was that we were always trying to think things out freshly. It wasn't a cult. It wasn't an orthodoxy. It wasn't the church that you had to depart from with great fanfare. So, fine, I'm for many thoughts. Why stop at two?
Was writing this book an important personal experience for you? Do you feel that you've reconciled some things for yourself in having written it?
I actually do. I know that sounds a little pat, but it was not easy. It was painful in many places. It was sometimes hard. It was hard to crack into some of the old feelings and observations, and once into them, it was hard to crack back out. I do think that it settled some things for me, and I recommend the process.
Can I ask you in a couple of seconds to tell what one of the things that it settled for you was?
Well, it I think it reminded me of how alluring some of that energy is. It made it clearer to me why so many people who at certain points knew better found themselves thinking three impossible things before breakfast, including that there was a revolution afoot. It also, I think, reminded me that it was right in many ways to think that you could change the world if you did the right things and were serious enough about it. And I think it's fine to remember that today, too.
Todd Gitlin, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Todd Gitlin. He's a writer, media critic, and a professor of sociology at the University of California at Berkeley. He's written a new book titled The 60s, Years of Hope, Days of Rage. It's published by Bantam Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Edna Buchanan. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning police reporter for the Miami Herald. She's written about her adventures on the beat in a new book titled The Corpse Had a Familiar Face. I hope you can join us.
Time ago, a crazy dream came to me. I dreamt I was walking in World War III. Went to the doctor the very next day to see what kind of words he could say. Said it was a bad dream.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, syndicated political cartoonist Dan Wasserman tells when it's okay to give the president a break. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album by Art Farmer, featuring compositions by Billy Strayhorn. And David Bianculli has a preview of Beverly Hills Bunce, the new series that brings back a couple of Hill Street Blues alumni. Dennis Franz as Detective Norman Bunce, and Peter Jurasik as his sidekick, Sid the Snitch. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Michael Richards in Washington. Soviet General Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev today condemned Joseph Stalin's abuse of power and promised to impose fully new economic reforms within 3 years. Soviet experts say the 3.5-hour speech shows that Gorbachev's political strength is growing, but so is resistance to his planned changes. More from Jeremy Harris in Moscow.
This was Mr. Gorbachev in a somewhat different role from the one to which Soviet and foreign audiences have become accustomed. Less Gorbachev the instigator and motor of the Soviet reform program than Gorbachev its arbiter and guardian. It's a shift that responds in part to the occasion. The Soviet leader was in effect sitting in judgment on the entire 70 years of Soviet history. His criticism of Stalin, though forthright, was careful to balance round condemnation of the purges with praise for Stalin's role in building Soviet power at home and abroad. The nature of Stalin's legacy is one of the issues that divides the committed reformers from more conservative elements in the Soviet hierarchy. However, Mr. Gorbachev's speech also seems to reflect more immediate high-level divisions that have emerged over the pace and ultimate fate of the reform program.
The BBC's Jeremy Harris in Moscow. A U.S. warship opened fire on a suspected Iranian patrol boat, the Pentagon announced today. The incident took place yesterday when the Iranian vessel reportedly moved menacingly toward a U.S. freighter in the Gulf and ignored warning shots. The Pentagon says the Iranian boat backed off after being fired upon. The stock market closed almost 19.5 points higher today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average finished past the 2000 level at 2012.93. Analysts welcomed what one called a return to sanity in a market rocked by sharp swings in the past 2 weeks. About 176 million shares were traded in an abbreviated session. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 43 cents. William Sessions was sworn in today as director of the FBI. Flanked by President Reagan and Attorney General Edwin Meese, Sessions said he'll work to be an effective director.
My hope is that I can so faithfully uphold the standards of the Federal Bureau of Investigation that when my term is completed, my associates here at the Bureau will regret my departure.
Sessions replaces William Webster, who now heads the CIA. The White House was asked today about the fact that Supreme Court nominee Douglas Ginsburg had about $140,000 invested in a cable television company when he argued a case before the High Court involving expansion of the cable industry. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says the Reagan administration is aware of the incident, and he says it's not a problem. In Northern Ireland, there were violent clashes today between police and mourners at the joint funeral of two IRA gunmen in Londonderry. Authorities say 20 police officers and 9 civilians were injured. Leslie Van Slyke reports.
The trouble flared as the funeral procession was making its way to the cemetery. A lone masked IRA gunman stepped out of the crowd, stood between the two flag-draped coffins, and fired a volley of shots as a final tribute. Dozens of riot police at the front and rear of the procession then surrounded the crowd of more than 2,000 mourners in an effort to arrest the gunman. The police then opened fire on the mourners with plastic bullets and moved in with clubs. In the ensuing panic, the gunman was able to escape, and the two IRA men were finally laid to rest. They blew themselves up last week while transporting a bomb through the city. The policing of political funerals has become an increasingly controversial issue here, and this latest incident will only add to the tension. For National Public Radio, I'm Leslie Van Slyke in Belfast.
Ex-White House Chief of Staff Michael Deaver was released from the hospital today, and his trial for perjury will resume tomorrow. Deaver entered Georgetown University Hospital over the weekend, complaining of pain from kidney stones. I'm Michael Richards in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Art Farmer is one of the few jazz musicians whose first instrument is flugelhorn. Flugelhorn is like a trumpet, but it's slightly larger and with a deeper, more mellow sound. Farmer has a new album on which he plays the music of Billy Strayhorn. Strayhorn was Duke Ellington's associate and collaborator for nearly 30 years. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says the album is a perfect marriage of the composer's and the performer's lyrical sensibilities.
Twenty years after Billy Strayhorn's death, we're in the midst of a Strayhorn revival. Duke Ellington's 1967 tribute to his recently deceased collaborator, and his mother called him Bill, has been reissued on RCA compact disc. Pianist Marion McPartland has an all-Strayhorn set out now on Concord. And then there's Art Farmer's Something to Live For, the music of Billy Strayhorn, a quintet album on Contemporary. It's one of the prettiest and most satisfying sets I've heard in months. Billy Strayhorn was often called Ellington's alter ego, a composer whose lush harmonic sense appealed to Ellington's taste for rich orchestrations. True enough. But hearing Billy Strayhorn's music in a basic quintet setting reminds us how deceptively simple his melodies could be when constructed from one or two ingeniously varied phrases or intervals. His shapely melodies make it easy for thoughtful improvisers to respond with well-sculpted statements of their own. Art Farmer's flugelhorn solo on Johnny Come Lately is a case in point. Jazz musicians are better attuned to Strayhorn's lyricism than flugelhorn player Art Farmer. His tone is one of the warmest in jazz. He seems to have used Miles Davis's intimate trumpet sound of the 50s as his departure point. Indeed, Farmer should be celebrated by every fan who laments Davis's turn away from acoustic jazz. But Art Farmer also enjoys a mastery of brass technique that Davis at his peak would be hard-pressed to match. Listen to the warmth and elegance of Farmer's solo on the Strayhorn ballad, Something to Live For. Thank you. That's Art Farmer on Billy Strayhorn's Something to Live For. But excerpts don't really do this music justice. One of its pleasures is hearing how well integrated the solos of Farmer, tenor saxophonist Clifford Jordan, and pianist James Williams are, and how sensitively bassist Rufus Reed and drummer Marvin Smitty Smith underscore and subtly direct their musings. These performances aren't mere strings of solos. There's an underlying unity of tone derived from each composition's strong personality. The quintet's interplay and empathy make these Strayhorn compositions, some dating back to the late 30s and early 40s, sound perfectly fresh, truly timeless. Art Farmer turned 59 this year. Clifford Jordan is 56. But in the course of their long careers, neither has played as deeply or as well as they do nowadays. They're among the many jazz musicians who've continued to grow at an age when younger folk may think them ready to call it a day. By contrast, Billy Strayhorn, who died at age 51, always seemed wise beyond his years. Some believe he wrote the world-weary Lush Life while still in his teens. The contrast between Billy Strayhorn's precocity and world-weariness and Art Farmer's experience and enthusiasm give the album Something to Live For an uncommonly rich emotional texture.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat, Cadence, and Jazz Times. He reviewed Art Farmer's new album, Something to Live For, the music of Billy Strayhorn, on the Contemporary record label. You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is syndicated political cartoonist Dan Wasserman. He broke into the field during the 1980 presidential campaign, cartooning for the Washington Star. When the Star folded, he went freelance and was picked up by the Los Angeles Times Syndicate. 2 years ago, he moved to Boston and joined the staff of the Boston Globe. Wasserman has collected some of his favorite cartoons in his first book, We've Been Framed.
I have a cartoon that shows two Contras emptying a large crate that's marked Contra Aid from the U.S. They say to themselves, they've sent us ammo, they've sent us boots, they've sent us clothing, they've sent us medical supplies, they sent us munitions. And then as they get way down to the bottom of the box, they look desperately and one of them says, where's the popular support?
How about a cartoon about taxes?
Well, I've got a cartoon of a couple. I did this right before April 15th, I guess last year. A couple sitting in the dining room covered with papers and calculators and pencils and coffee cups, and they're both looking very harried, and the wife says to the husband, I thought they were going to simplify taxes. And the husband says, they did. Now we send the check directly to the Pentagon.
Your views are obviously left of center. Has it become any more difficult in the 80s for liberal cartoonists to get work?
I think there's more of an opening for cartoonists on the left than there is probably for commentators that work in other media. I think early in the Reagan administration, there was a notion that the guy had such enormous popularity that newspapers didn't want to buck that trend too hard. So I got a lot more criticism in 81 and 82 for knocking Reagan than I have in his second term, where I think some of the craziness of his programs and his attitude toward running the government have become obvious to people.
In the introduction to your new book of cartoons, you describe President Reagan as a running character in your cartoon strip, which I thought that was a very funny way of looking at it. How did you start to feel that way?
He seems to me to be divorced from reality a lot of the time and kind of live in a make-believe world. And the more that I drew him, the more he became like a comic strip character. Most often when I draw a politician, I go back and look at photographs, look at how I've drawn him before. And Reagan, partly through practice, but I think also partly through his personality, after a while, I didn't check back. He seemed to have a kind of comic life that was pretty much divorced from his actual physical motions and appearance. And it seemed that his administration took on the character of a comic strip storyline.
Let's get to the real issues here. You, of course, do your version of his hairdo, but I've noticed that you draw it two different ways, or over the years you've done it two different ways. Would you describe both of the hairdos you've given him?
Yeah, early on I gave him sort of a modified punk do, which looked like four or five spikes sticking up out of his head. And I changed that right about the time of his re-election in 84, mostly because graphically I liked it the way it looked frontally, but when I turned him, it was hard to decide what those spikes did, and it was visually confusing. So I gave him a fuller, rounded pompadour that he now sports.
Slightly lopsided.
It is slightly lopsided. And I've noticed, actually, over the years that his barber has gone to some pains to kind of whittle that down.
Well, you know, but I was just going to mention, on his last press conference, his hair seemed considerably closer to his head, less piled up than it used to be.
Yeah, I think that'd be sort of an interesting photo essay to do on Reagan's hair over the last 7 years. But there has been an effort to kind of tone that down, but in my cartoons, he's stuck with the original do.
Are there ever times when you feel that it's your moral responsibility to go easy on him? For instance, if when Nancy was in the hospital having breast surgery done, was that a time when you'd feel like, oh, you have to go easy on him because there's a crisis in the family?
I think so. I think it's important to understand that this is not a personal exchange. This is a political exchange, and that you have to respect people's problems, personal situations. When he was shot, when he's been in for surgery, when his wife's had problems. My attitude is, lay off for a week. Let the guy recuperate.
Do you ever have to tone down a cartoon before your paper or before the syndicate will print it?
I guess maybe I've done that once or twice. Usually a cartoon works or it doesn't work. And when you start to monkey with it to satisfy somebody's notion of moderation, you kill it. So my usual approach is, if the editor wants it changed, that's essentially the end of the cartoon, unless I can convince him that it doesn't need to be changed.
Is there an example of a cartoon that you killed because of that?
I had a cartoon on Gary Hart and his womanizing problem that was actually killed twice. The first time I drew it was before the Donna Rice affair had come to light. The cartoon showed Hart having a daydream of a scantily clad woman and proclaiming out to the audience, "I share the vision of FDR and JFK." My editor thought that was unfair to Hart. Then after the Donna Rice story came to light, I resubmitted it because it seemed to me there wasn't much question anymore about what was going on. And I was told that it couldn't run because it was unfair to FDR.
But it's in your book.
It's in the book, but it never appeared in the Boston Globe.
Oh. What was your most controversial cartoon that got printed?
There are two of them that have to do with the Catholic Church that appeared this year. That caused a huge outcry in Boston. One of them was on the Vatican's statement about artificial means of conception, and I did a cardinal holding up the statement and proclaiming in Old English lettering, "We make babies the old-fashioned way," which I thought was sort of a gentle, friendly little satire on their statement that they were opposed to. in vitro fertilization and surrogate motherhood. But people were very sensitive about this, and I was surprised at the reaction.
Is the Pope an untouchable for a political cartoonist?
No, he shouldn't be. I mean, my position, and in general there's an agreement at the paper about this, is that when the church steps into the political arena, then they're fair game like everybody else.
There was another cartoon you were going to mention?
Oh, I did a cartoon on the audience that the Pope gave Waldheim earlier this year. And I have Waldheim dressed in a little stormtrooper uniform in the plaza outside the Vatican, yelling up to the Vatican, "I have war crimes to confess." And out of the Vatican comes the answer through one of the windows, "Yours or ours."
Oh, gee.
And this made a lot of people uncomfortable, not just Catholics, but a lot of Jews called me up and said, "How could you do this? This is just reopening old wounds." And my feeling was that the wounds had been reopened by the visit, and it might be good to look at the history of what this relationship was about. And I think there are a lot of people who would rather forget about it.
From a cartoonist point of view, is there anyone who you think would be especially good to run for president?
One of the important secrets of the current presidential campaign is that there's a lot of cartoonist money going to Al Haig.
Why is that?
He's got a great face. He mangles the English language. He's loves to dress up in costumes. He's just about perfect. So we're banking on Al.
Dan Wasserman, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks a lot.
Political cartoonist Dan Wasserman. His new book is titled We've Been Framed. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. John Hockenberry is co-hosting the program, and he's joining us from Washington. Hi, John.
Hi, Terry.
What story is he following?
This week begins the Soviet commemoration of the 70th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution, and we kick off a week of coverage of that event. Robert Siegel is in Moscow, which is why I'm here in Washington. In any case, we have three reports tonight. One, a portrait of a refusenik family. We have a look at a major speech by Mikhail Gorbachev today, and a remembrance by NPR's Daniel Shore of Nikita Khrushchev. Also, a portrait of a gunmaker in Montana, a look at Quebecois separatist René Lévesque, who died over the weekend, and a look at a court system in West Virginia, which is very activist. All that.
Thanks, John. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If you were a Hill Street Blues fan, then we've got an item of interest for you. This week, Beverly Hills Bunce, a half-hour weekly drama, premieres on NBC. It's a spin-off from Hill Street, which was canceled at the end of last season. Our television critic David Bianculli has a review.
Dennis Franz and Peter Jurassic, who played Norman Bunce and Sid the Snitch on Hill Street Blues, were the energy source that kept that show alive during its last two seasons. That's why it's understandable, and kind of nice, that out of all the cast members of that superb ensemble series, Franz and Jurassic are the ones who were chosen to keep the Hill Street flame alive. They're the stars of a new series called Beverly Hills Bunce, which will pop up now and then on Thursday nights. It's what NBC is calling a designated hitter series, one that shows up about once a month. But before long, Beverly Hills Bunce should get its own weekly slot. The other designated hitters have struck out, but Beverly Hills Bunce slams a homer. The show begins right where Norm's job on Hill Street ended, with him punching Police Chief Daniels, throwing down his badge, and walking out the door. The pilot episode for Beverly Hills Bunce sends the not-so-dynamic duo out to California, where Norm tries to set himself up as a detective, and Sid quietly runs a few scams on the side. But unlike Randy Newman, who sang I Love L.A., Norman Bunce isn't so sure.
You know what I realized driving home, Sid? I could have thrown a dart into one of those freaking road maps, all the common sense there was to me coming out here.
Area's job generator number one, census after census.
You know the truth? Why I came out here?
Why?
It's the farthest from where I was. It wasn't coming to. It was where I was going from.
Norman comes into his own, though, when Rebecca Griswold, a young woman whose office is down the hall from his, is cheated out of $2,000 by a guy named Ronald, who beats her up and leaves her with a bloody lip. Norman flies off in pursuit, catches up to the guy in the elevator, and confronts him in classic Norman Bunce style.
There's cops coming up here.
What?
You got two choices. A is you give me the ladies $2,000, I let you see, can you outrun the boys in blue? Or B, you could try to save the $2,000 by duking me how you did Miss Griswold. Ronald chooses B.
Jeffrey Lewis and David Milch, who wrote that scene, and Gabrielle Beaumont, who directed it, all worked on Hill Street, so Beverly Hills Bunce couldn't be in better hands. It's so good a show, in fact, that it demands a reevaluation of one of my 10 warning signs of bad TV, the one that warns viewers to spin away from spinoffs. For nearly a decade, every new show that's been spun off from an old one has been a dud. This season, there's been only one other spinoff series, and that's A Different World from The Cosby Show. So far, that show has been no big deal. And the only other spinoffs on network TV now have been around so long that it's hard to remember what shows they came from. Who still connects Knott's Landing with Dallas, or The Facts of Life with Different Strokes? You have to go all the way back to 1978, when Mork and Mindy sprang from Happy Days, to find a spinoff series worth getting excited about. Since then, TV's tried to spin off Aftermath from MASH, Roxy from Kate and Allie, the Colbys from Dynasty, and the Tortellis, from Cheers, and failed with them all. Beverly Hills Bunce, though, is a major success and could revive the spinoff the way The Cosby Show revived the sitcom. Beverly Hills Bunce not only outlives Hill Street, but outshines it, too, at least when compared to the show's waning years. Until this week, the most famous Sid couple may have been Sid and Nancy. From now on, it's Sid and Norman.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with fashion photographer Bruce Weber. He's responsible for the burnished, muscular glow of the Calvin Klein and Ralph Lauren ads. He's just completed his first film, a documentary about young boxers. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will profile Dyke and the Blazers, a 60s soul group that put Phoenix, Arizona on the soul map. And book critic John Leonard will review the autobiography of Solidarity leader Lech Walesa. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's show is produced by Fred Landerl, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Dougherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Orji Vablitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.